The Saturday Panel on Off the Ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're very welcome along to our Saturday panel. Well, quite often in sports broadcasting, we lose one of ourselves. We get caught up in the hyperbole and we might blow people's achievements to a level that maybe they're not quite at. Today is not one of those days. The three men alongside me have quite literally scaled Everest. It's great to have you all here. Dr. Roger McMorrow, you scaled Everest back in 2007, so quite a while ago at this stage. Rob Martell, 2016, and John Burke, most recently, just last summer. Thanks a lot for coming in. It is somewhat ironic that we were due to host this panel 3 weeks ago, but we had to postpone it because of the snow. I'm going to say that that's because you listen to warnings, and when you hear the red warning, you think, no, we're advised to stay inside, we're going to do just that. It's a pretty elite club. Irish people who have scaled Everest under 50 have done it. Is it a club? Is it something you meet up and discuss your adventures and give tips, advice?
I think over the years, and especially when people are probably planning their Everest expeditions, that's when the club starts to form in terms of sharing of advice. You know, retrospectively, there's not really much of a backpatting club. It's more of a passing on, you know, knowledge and learnings and, you know, gear tips, various, you know, what would you say? Like, we had a number of chats last year.
Yeah, Rob was a great help to me for advice, and certain people, I think, take on board an awful lot more information than others, and you were one of those people that were like an encyclopedia of all the do's and don'ts of Everest.
Can you have too much information?
I think, yeah, you kind of have to filter out where you are. And you were very clear about that with me. You said, look, you told me that you're an encyclopedia of Everest, and to you know, pick and choose which bits of nuggets of information that I feel appropriate to me. But but you certainly try to find people with information. Actually, I met Roger about 10 years ago, since I was in your house, which was the very early days. You were pointing Everest to me on a map at that stage. I was so green, I didn't know the top of it from the bottom at that stage. But I remember you were pointing a few mountains beside it, and I said, is that K2? And I remember being so embarrassed afterwards, and I realized we were in completely different countries. So I was, so you certainly tried to soak
up. You did climb Everest in the end, though. Was the right mountain you got to?
I hope so, anyway.
I think part of your initial advice is trying to put most people off from doing it, and trying to say, look, you know, if you really, really want to do this, you should probably do a few other things first. And most of us would have climbed in the Himalayas before going to Everest. I think, you know, there's only one way to find out if you're good at altitude. You can't really do it by going to the Alps or anything. You know, you just have to get high and see can you cope with it. And it's not just about the climb itself, but just living in the harsh environment for such a long period of time takes a lot of preparation. And climbing Everest is almost like it's like having the world's biggest game of stare, only the mountain never blinks and never looks away. You know, so a lot of people, you know, a lot of the psychology of just being away and looking at this thing for a long period of time is hard, and knowing that you're going to be able to cope with that is probably as good a preparation as any.
It's 11 years since you scaled Everest. Does the mountain evolve? Does the mountain change? Does your advice for people going to scale Everest, would it be as relevant now as it was 10 years ago? Or does the challenge change from year to year, from season to season?
No, I think the challenge is largely the same. I mean, the big challenge of Everest is the altitude. You know, pure and simply, it stands head and shoulders above even all the highest other mountains. There's 14 mountains over 8,000 meters in the world, and they're all in the Himalayas, and Everest stands even, you know, a good chunk higher than the vast majority of them. So altitude is the issue with Everest. The technical ability, technical skill in Everest is relatively low compared to, say, a mountain like K2, where the technical skill is very high. But just because it's technically okay doesn't mean it's easy to climb. You know, it's about living and keeping yourself fit and healthy and avoiding the deterioration that happens. I mean, one of the biggest things is that minor issues become major issues on Everest, like an upset tummy, you know, could kill you at one of the higher camps because you suddenly get dehydrated or can't walk or can't eat, you know. Whereas, you know, on a camping trip, you know, in Scotland, it it wouldn't be an issue at all, you know. So being able to, one of the skills of climbing Everest is things like, you know, good toilet hygiene, you know, not avoiding, you know, infections between you, you know, and keeping healthy so that when you have that opportunity to actually go for the summit that you're as fit and healthy as possible.
You need to be meticulous then in your preparation and the way you act when you're there. And I guess you need to be probably quite harsh on the people around you as well, that they're living up to the same standards.
Yeah, there'd be a huge discipline amongst the teams. And some teams take a different approach. They'll take a more laissez-faire approach. The majority of teams will take an extremely disciplined, ultra-hygienic approach to everything they do, and just being very methodical in all of their processes and getting everything right. Because, it, as Roger said, the smallest of things that can go wrong can often just tumble and become an expedition.
But if one person in your group gets a tummy bug, there's a high chance somebody else is going to get it.
Mm. Yeah. These things can spread. And, you know, the mountain, we mentioned earlier that, you know, the two sides of the mountain, being the north and south, are quite different. And people do face slightly different challenges between the two also. You know, even if we talk about the health aspect, the approach to the mountain on the north side is by vehicle. So you don't trek to base camp, you take roads. But in those vehicles, you've got 6 to 8 people per vehicle, all breathing the same air for hours and hours and hours for 3 and 4 days together in this little cubicle. And that, from the very outset, exposes you to everybody else and the risks that they may bring with them from home, you know, if they had a little bit of cold. You know, ultimately, you're
it's
one of the greatest...
dish of illness and every little bug.
Yeah, one of the greatest fears, or concerns at least, would be that if you get a cough quite early on in the expedition, and if that sees you through to higher elevation, quite often people can find that there's not enough air in the environment to get a good cough, and they end up breaking their ribs through just coughing alone. You can cough so strong that you break your ribs in the upper elevations.
Mm-hmm. We might talk about your various stories then, and why you wanted to go up, and your experience then of getting to the top of Everest. Roger, what was your motivation? When did you decide? What stage of your life were you at when you thought, yeah, I want to go and do this?
Well, I joined the mountaineering club at university, and I went away to the Alps with them on the first summer, and I climbed Mont Blanc when I was 19, and I really enjoyed it. It was by far and away the highest I'd ever been, and I just had this question, how high could I go? I don't think at that stage I wanted to climb Everest. I mean, obviously I knew Everest from when I was a child, and it's probably one of the first mountains that most kids even know the name of. So there's always that sort of lingering fascination with it. And then I just started to conspire to go on trips to get higher and higher, and began to think, you know, well, maybe this is a possibility. The big barrier of Everest is the cost and price. And I managed to get in with a group of other doctors from the UK who were interested in climbing it and interested in doing a research expedition on it, which meant we could probably raise funding for it, i.e. get someone to pay for it. So we conceived this expedition around the single idea of taking a sample of arterial blood from the summit of Everest. So no one had ever done that before or even come close. It's a type of a sample that we regularly do in hospitals. We knew theoretically it would be a very low sample, but no one had actually ever put a number on it. And this would have been the lowest oxygen level that would have ever been recorded in a healthy human. And you know, obviously, we know that, you know, lack of oxygen is bad, but where do you draw the line? And we wanted to put the number on that line. So we built the expedition around this idea of how we could get the sample, and then what other science we could do around it. And it ended up being called the Caudwell Extreme Everest Expedition, after our main sponsor, John Caudwell, who was the phones for you guy, who gave us a big chunk of money. We built the expedition. We had over 60 different research projects going on. We had still things like we managed to carry a bog standard. Well, we didn't, the Sherpas did, carry a bog standard exercise bike right up to the last camp at 8,000 metres and do some cardiopulmonary exercise testing.
They looked cheap.
Well, they were paid well for it. And so we have the claim that we've done the world's highest cardiopulmonary exercise testing. We did psychology testing and things like that. And we also managed to get the arterial blood gas sample not quite from the summit, but just below it at a place called the Balcony. And we took samples of blood from the femoral artery. And then we had a Sherpa runner who was on John's trip. And he ran down the mountain with the samples to a lab, where we built a lab with a blood gas analyzer and got the result.
Wow. So were you trying to test the body at the ordinary limits of Everest, or then when you got up there, were you trying to push yourself to another level again?
Well, we wanted to see the ordinary levels of Everest because simply, you know, we knew people would get very, very low oxygen. We wanted to know what that number was. For example, in intensive care, in hospitals, if your oxygen level in your blood goes below 10, you'll be calling an anaesthetist or an intensivist to come and help. You'll probably by 8 be on a ventilator, okay. And by about 6, we would be calling the family in to discuss end of life care. The number that we got on Everest was 2.5. So incredibly lower than where we would be drawing the line in patients in intensive care. And the remarkable thing is that that's down at the same level as diving mammals. So within about 6 to 8 weeks of acclimatization, the human can adapt sufficiently to be operating on levels of oxygen that diving mammals have evolved to do quite normally.
So how do you take that research then and apply it to real life when you come back?
Diving, I think.
Yeah. Well, I guess it means that you know, there's no magic to acclimatization. It's all mediated by DNA and protein expression. And the idea would be, once we understand the process better, is that you could give someone, say, when you're going in 40 years time for your coronary bypass operation, you know, we could give you a drug to pre-acclimatize you to extremely low oxygen levels like you'd find in Everest without having to do the 8 weeks acclimatization, so that then you would tolerate much greater insults during surgery and things like that. So it's a long process. We don't have something right now, but it's about understanding how the human can go from that to from us sitting here to being able to acclimatize in Everest. And just to finish up, one of the reasons you can ask, well, why do we have this ability at all? And right now, basically, the fetuses and babies are operating on similarly extremely low oxygen levels. So you have that ability within your DNA to cope with extremely low oxygen levels. We lose a lot of it once we're born, but you do retain some of that ability to switch those genes back on.
That's incredible. I'd be interested to hear the other lads' experience of going up, because essentially they went up for the crack, whereas you went up to work. Was it a very enjoyable experience, or were you fearful when you were up there, or was it very much because you had this work side of it? Did that almost keep your mind focused in a different way?
Well, there's kind of two things. I mean, trips away for such a length of time are all about the people that you're with. So you can have a great time or a terrible time depending on the people you're with, particularly the person you're sharing a tent with. I mean, I've been a climber for a long time. I've been to the Himalayas 5 times. I've been to all the other greater ranges. And so I was quite comfortable with the environment. And but Everest does carry this this perception of risk. And there is the constant threat of avalanche or crevasse or sudden sickness or cerebral edema or pulmonary edema, some of the serious altitude things. And I kind of likened it to knowing someone wanted to kill you, but you never knew when they were going to do it. And it's just that pervasive stress of not, it's not like having a gun pointed in your face, but the pervasive stress of knowing someone out there wanted to do you harm, and just that you're slightly on edge all the time because of it. It wasn't a
situation. So you're not quite offering yourself up to the mountain and accepting if this is going to happen, it's going
to
happen?
No, no one wants to die. I was quite glad to come home.
Yeah. Rob, tell us your story.
Yeah, my story would have started back probably in university again. Again, not with the Everest in mind, quite similar to Roger, but it was more with mountaineering and enjoying, you know, the mountains and the great outdoors. I sometimes joke that it was more my lack of imagination that brought me around to it as an accountant. I've been a skier all my life, and all I did was just turn skiing upside down and went uphill. So that's probably where the creativity came to, the end of my creativity. Yeah. But from that point, we explored, how one would prepare to climb mountains in the Alps, myself and my brother at the time.
What age are you?
I am 26. No, I'm 28 now.
What age were you?
Then I was about 20. We were looking at climbing in the Alps. We'd been there all of our lives skiing, always admiring the big peaks and the Matterhorn and things like that. So we set about seeing how it could be done, and pretty quickly came to the conclusion that this isn't a game built for us. We're not capable, equipped, experienced, or anything, any of the above. So we quickly dismissed the idea and moved on with our lives, only to return to it about a year or two later. At that point...
What changed?
I don't know what changed, possibly just that little bit older and that little bit more determined to explore what was really involved this time.
But all those things you had just stated as negatives were things you could actually probably work through.
Over time, we wanted to explore how long it would take to work through them. We both knew that we were reasonably fit individuals to begin with, and we were experienced in snowy environments. But we just needed to see how to put the two together and learn the technical skills to, create that experience. So we reached out to a lot of different mountain guides, spoke to a lot of people that told us, what sort of progression we should plan. And ultimately, we were fortunate enough to summit the Matterhorn a year or two later. From that point, it moved on to, I wonder... what else is out there? And Paul Devaney, actually, he said, if you really want to test yourself on big mountains, you need to go to bigger mountains than the Alps. The Alps is where you'll do a lot of technical work, but if you want to see big mountains, you need to go to Alaska and test your mind and your body out in longer expeditions to see what you can do. And it sort of tumbled from there. I'd set a potential, pathway to Everest, the required mountains that you should get under your belt in terms of experience, like Roger mentioned already. You can't just go from the Alps to Everest. You can't go from anything just to Everest. You need to build a whole array of experience and knowledge along the way. So I set out that path quietly, didn't really advertise the fact that there was a path in mind, and I just quietly, worked through one mountain at a time. And a couple of weeks before Everest happened, I said, "Oh, looks like I'm actually ready to give this a go."
It still feels like quite a, excuse upon a rapid ascent. In that, from being 20, started thinking about this and not really being sure, to within 7 years actually climbing Everest.
It was an intense 7 years. Yeah, someone asked recently, how did you go through, all of this training plus, the rest of your education, professional qualifications, plus actually working full time and the rest? And the answer is, not sleeping much. There's no simple way to getting more hours in the day than reducing the hours that are lost to sleep. It's not a sustainable approach, but... it can be sustained for a period of time to get enough out of yourself.
you need to be incredibly disciplined. Like, how long did you go through that of still studying while still cutting back in your sleep? Like,
the whole way through.
How extreme was it?
I was doing exams up until and after Everest. So that only came to an end about a year ago. So that was persistent the whole way through. And it was truly through discipline. You know, there was no time lost doing things that didn't need to be done. Watching
you TV. Just sacrifice everything else?
Yeah, you know, watching TV was done on a stationary bike while I was getting in a workout. You know, that's how you catch up on Narcos or whatever it is you're watching. Narcos isn't a great one for stationary bikes. The rhythm's all wrong. you know, that's how it happened. You know, it was just through discipline and the support of a huge amount of people around me. A lot of them didn't quite realize the support they were giving at the time. Because most didn't know what I had in mind. They just saw this as, oh, you know, Rob's just busy training and busy doing his thing. And so many people stepped in, and I'm hugely grateful and, you know, thankful for that.
At what stage do you start thinking about Everest? That this is the ultimate, this is where I want to end up?
The whole way through, and not at all. It was very much an indecisive moment, because I always wanted to reserve that place in my mind where I'm willing to back down from the expedition without saying that I've backed down. You know, and I was worried that I could talk myself into a position where I feel that I have to go for the sake of keeping up appearances. And I never wanted to maintain any appearances, so I kept the expedition quite low profile, and even in my own mind, until I just did the training, learned about what altitude would do to myself, you know, mentally and physically, how these long expeditions would work, and always taking time to reflect after each expedition. Do I really want to go that little bit further? You know, maybe I'll pull back, do some smaller mountains, enjoy those, maybe I'll push harder. You know, I wanted to buy myself some time after every expedition without any judgment on what will happen in the future.
Yeah, by the sounds of what you're saying, Everest isn't for everybody actually an achievable goal. If you were to do everything right physically, do all the training, get your fitness to such a high level, mentally be prepared and be able to handle that, some people's bodies just aren't capable. Yeah. And you won't know that till you get there.
Yeah, and you try and find that out sooner rather than later, which is why you go to all the other mountains, and learning what your body will do at the various increments. You know, you don't have to go to Everest to find out if 7,000 metres is too much, and equally, people don't always have the same experience at 7,000 meters, because it can just depend on what led up towards you reaching a certain elevation. Were you dehydrated? Had you had an illness? Who knows how you're going to react the second time around?
Mm. John, did these sound like familiar stories?
Yeah, very familiar, particularly where Rob says that it was always the goal, but never really the goal. You know, it was about 10 years ago when I set my sights on Everest, and 11 years ago, 10 years from when I summited.
Where were you in your life at that stage?
So I'd given up sport really from about 16. So it was I was very unfit at this stage. I'd given up sport from about 16. I'd started working and kind of pursue my career really very much intensively for a long period of time.
What do you do?
I'm in the hotel business in Spanish Point, the Armada Hotel there in Spanish Point.
Good plug.
Yeah, I got in.
Special covers for all off the ball listeners.
Covers the field on the way up. So I throw myself into that, and I suppose I look back, you know, after a long time working fairly intensely without any sport or any activity whatsoever, and I had a lot of regrets. I was watching lads, friends of mine who were playing with Clare and doing really good in their own fields of sport, and I look back with a lot of regret that, you know, I never really tested myself in terms of what my body physically was capable of doing. And I was in an industry where you're, I suppose, surrounded by all the comforts of, you know, warm, cozy environment, unlimited food, unlimited drinks. You know, it's just I felt that when I was deciding on a career, I was either the hotel industry or the army, and I suppose I was really thinking I took the soft option.
You were having a comfortable life.
I was having, things were fairly comfortable, and I had all the signs of it as well. So I read an article about Everest. It was from Pat Falvey, and just something resonated with me. I think I was probably at the point in time my dad had passed away short time before that, and he was quite young when he died, and I felt that, you know, unless I did something, unless I made some changes, that I wasn't going to live my life to its fullest potential. So I needed to find something, and it was just that light bulb moment when I read the article. What was it about it that appealed to me? I think it was the fact that, I suppose, one thing was that, you know, the older you got, not necessarily were you disimproving or reducing your chances of summiting, because while you're physically, you know, losing some strength, perhaps you're mentally gaining a lot of strength and willpower and determination. So I knew that it was something I could work towards for a period of time. And I suppose for me it was just the ultimate test of kind of the body, and I also knew I didn't have much hand-eye coordination or foot-eye coordination, so something that wasn't too skillful suited me as a sport. So it really appealed to me, and it was from then on I set off on the journey, always with Everest in mind, but at the same time it was just getting through each hurdle. I was very conscious that I wanted to enjoy the journey as I went along. The first person I met really to talk about Everest was with Roger, and you know, each time you're picking up little bits of information, and each expedition you're learning new skills, and I suppose that when you come back from each one you generally say, Jesus, you know, that was horrible and I'm never doing that again.
A few weeks later,
you're back and you're researching.
When you met Roger 10 years ago or so, how high had you climbed?
I don't think I'd even been to the Alps at this stage. I'd say I just climbed Cairn Toul and a few bits at this stage.
You're talking, Roger, about maybe convincing people not to do it, and a guy comes in and he's very much a dreamer and I want to climb Everest, do you try and break it down into practical steps?
You didn't break it down very well.
I think it's probably the same difficulty of explaining to someone who's not a parent what it's like to be a parent. You actually just can't understand until you go do it.
You just give your life to it.
I think, you know, I've spoken to various people over the years about it, and you get people who come with no background or people who have a lot of mountaineering under their belt, and you know, until you've been in the mountains and been on longer trips and lived in a tent and, you know, melted snow to make your dinner and have a cup of tea, it's kind of hard to really see whether you like it. And I mean, in climbing I always talk about there's three types of fun. There's type 1, 2 and 3 fun. Type 1 fun is fun at the time, it's great fun, it's always fun. Type 2 is, it's not fun at the time, but afterwards when you come back you realize, oh no, that was fun. And then type 3 fun is, it's not fun at the time, it's never going to be fun. No matter how much time passes, it's never fun. And a lot of climbing is type 2 fun, you know, where, you know, it's kind of, you're wondering, why am I doing this, you know?
Yeah.
And then you come home and think, that was great. You know, that was great fun, you know. So I think people need to, if people are interested in climbing Everest, the thing they should do is look up the Mountaineering Council of Ireland's website and join a club or join a group and get out into the hills. Scotland is really close. Mm. It gives a really good harsh winter every year, and you get lots of ice and snow in a relatively, you know, easy day outs from the car, you know. So if you're interested at all and you want to get out into wintry mountains, Scotland's a great place to go. And there's lots of courses you can do. There's companies that offer, you know, winter skills and things like that. So you can stepwise get into it, and rather than just go off and climb Everest. It's probably worth mentioning that among climbers and mountaineers, Everest doesn't have a fantastic reputation. It's sort of seen as the Ibiza destination of, a low technical mountain that thousands of people go to try and climb. And, you know, even around Everest, there's unclimbed peaks, you know, and... And certainly, Everest is not the only big mountain in the Himalayas, and there's lots of really valuable, really interesting, much cheaper, much more accessible mountains. And I'm not sure if you guys did, but did you guys climb Chul Yo preparation?
No, it was one of the potentials. Amit Ablam replaced it.
Amit Ablam's an amazing mountain. I'd love to climb it. I haven't done it yet, but it's on my tick list. And there are mountains in the Himalayas that are much cheaper, much more accessible, and much less time committing, and that people can do. And that would give you a good idea of whether you wanted to
a trek and even Island Peak, which is or Le Bourget, which is a great introduction. They're busier routes. You're on. You get a sense of what the Himalayas are about, and you kind of get a feel for it. About 20 or 25 days, maybe, of a trip, and get to 6,000 meters. You get to climb with Sherpas. You get to sleep at high camps and things like that, albeit only for a day or two at high camps. But yeah, you get a really good experience from time like that in the Himalayas, for sure.
The other thing that Rob mentioned was the support you get from friends and family, and I couldn't do this without acknowledging my wife and family's support, which was huge. And you know, one person can climb Everest, but it takes a village to get someone there, you know. So it's
I want to talk to you about that, and I want to take a quick ad break as well. And when you're talking about the other summits, I think it's interesting that obviously all three of you already climbed Everest, whereas I guess the dream for so many people is even just that name. It is the one, as you say, from being a child, you know the name of the mountain and you want to go. When you're going up, very much as I'm sort of putting this tag on you, the dreamer, you're the guy who like is sitting at home going, I need something, I need a goal. Is it a split when you're up there between people, say, who have very much from a young age practical mountaineering experience and have made their way up, to actually the people who this is their lifetime goal, this is the thing that they've built to for 5-6 years with the sole aim of wanting some sort of inner satisfaction of having done that?
So is there a split between different types of people on the mountain?
Different types of people.
Yeah, the mountain is just, it's just, yeah, there's
people of many different reasons have been there.
It's just incredible. Like, yeah, it's just this melting pot of people from all around the world, all levels of ability, all walks of life. There were like military teams. There were two different military teams there. One were the Gurkhas that were on Everest this year, and there was a team from the Pakistani army as well. There are people who are unbelievably experienced. Uli Steck was there while I was there with the probably the most famous mountaineer in the world at the time. I met him on the way in, and 2 weeks later he fell off the mountain. I was just 300 metres from him at the time, and descent broke up on the way down, died. So, you know, you have people, you know, that was a big shock, of course, as well for people at home, because everyone was there was a bit of publicity around Uli Steck. I was taking the selfies with him and things like that at home, and next thing, it was world news, I suppose, when it broke. So you have people at all different types of abilities, certainly there. I think I suppose everybody is there for their own reason. Everyone's there for their own, you know, to I suppose ultimately to climb Everest, and I think everyone's kind of fairly in harmony. There's within our expedition, there was great camaraderie between people, even though we were all there for different reasons, like other expeditions. Between expeditions, there really isn't any camaraderie, to be honest, and there wasn't really any interaction while I was there. You're very much on your own as an expedition, and outside of that, there isn't really any interaction at all, despite the only interaction this year was on the aggressive side, because one expedition was supposed to be fixing ropes and there were some delays on it, and there were fist fights breaking out between some expeditions
on
there.
The mountain.
So on the mountain, yeah, at base camp, it got fairly intense and got fairly aggressive. So it's a funny environment like that, all right.
Is there security up there?
Yeah, it was a little different, I think, on the north side. Thankfully, we didn't have any of the aggression, but I have seen it on other mountains. Occasionally, people possibly fighting over a camp area. That is well laid out, as opposed to one that has to be entirely constructed fresh.
Right.
In other countries, but on the north side of the mountain, there was a bit of a mix between the teams. People did sort of communicate between each other. There's a very large Russian team that is incredibly welcoming, and they were really the first class, everything in base camp that you could possibly imagine. Pool tables, table tennis, flat screen TVs. they had quite a peculiar setup, but they were so welcoming. And my team, which was quite basic, you would probably describe it as, enjoyed calling over to check out the pool tables on occasion. So they're quite.
Who carries the pool tables at the base camp?
They could drive them in the north side.
On the north side, you can drive them in, yeah.
So, why would anyone go on the south side?
One of the problems, there's a couple of problems with the north side. One of them being that by leaving Ireland and going on a couple of planes and a few day drive to base camp, all of a sudden you've gone from sea level to 5,500 metres with minimal acclimatization time. So that's one of the greatest problems from the outset, is that you're already on the back foot. You've gone to an elevation that your body isn't prepared for, in most cases. Now, I tackled that personally by spending 2 weeks in Nepal beforehand, to actually pre-acclimatise along the Southside Trek and to work my way gradually through the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 mark to ensure that I was on the right, you know, starting point when we arrived.
We are here on our Saturday panel with thanks to AIR, the home of AIR Sports. You can get amazing live sporting content free with AIR Broadband. We're talking about getting to the summit of Everest, and we're going to take a very quick break.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
In association with the AIR Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're welcome back to our Saturday panel. I'm joined by three men who have managed to make it to the top of Everest. Dr. Roger McMorrow, Rob Mortell and John Burke are alongside me in the studio. Roger, you were talking about the support base that needs to get you there. How do your family react when you say you're going to go to Everest?
Well, strategically, I married a climber as well, so that helped part of it. And we actually had our honeymoon at Everest Base Camp a few years before, so that she would actually know all about Everest. And we climbed Island Peak while we were there. Not the most luxurious honeymoon in the world, but
you're not just gone to the Maldives.
But no, we both love climbing, and we actually we didn't have kids at the time, but we had two kids before Everest. So that wasn't quite entirely.
You have your picture up on the screen there. This is on the summit of Everest.
And, I don't know if you can tell, but the little one was only born 3 weeks before I left for Everest. I'll let you read into family planning there. But, so we had two very, very small kids when I left. And so without the support of your family, you know, it's very hard to go away for 3 months and do something like that.
When you're leaving then and you're saying goodbye, like, are you saying goodbye very confident in not the knowledge that you're coming back, or is part of you thinking...
Well, it's funny. My wife might have a different viewpoint on this, but I remember when we were in the car once, and I wanted to assure her that I was going to be fine when I was away, and I'd take everything really safe. And I said, look, when I'm away, I'm not going to do anything dangerous. And she turned to me and said, you're not going to do anything dangerous while climbing Everest. I said, yeah, no, I'm going to take it really safe. I'm going to, and one of the things that I did was on the fixed ropes, you have a thing called a Jumar, which is a little device with a handle that clips on the rope, and it goes up, but it jams when it comes down. So the idea is that if you slip and fall, it'll jam and stop you. And every time you come to a knot or to a point on the rope where you have to switch it over, it's quite a laborious process where you take a clip, you clip it into the rope above, you unclip the rope, you put it in again, and you have to do that in the correct sequence, otherwise you won't be attached to the mountain. And there's an extra little thing you can do, which is you take one of the carabiners and you clip it into the Jumar, which prevents completely the rope from accidentally coming out. And most people don't do it because it's another thing that just you have to do. And so based on this premise, I promised my wife I wouldn't do anything dangerous. I called this little carabiner Mero Suramati, which is Nepalese for my wife. And every clip I put it in and said, this is what I meant when I said I was going to stay safe. So I was always really attached to the mountain. And
Oh, man.
She probably will have a different take on it.
I kind of had a different approach. My wife was aware that it was, I suppose, dangerous. She'd been to base camp as well, actually, and she came out with me this time to base camp. But I did a bit of a sports psychology, and I suppose each person, they have to customise the programme for each person. And for me, the fear of death was in the background there in some way, and we had to address it in a number of ways. And one of them was to write, get my will done, of course, and which I suppose everybody does, but also write the goodbye letters to my nearest and dearest. And it's really strange because while you're going out there and you're saying to yourself, and you're actually saying to people as well, look, I'm going to make the right decisions. Rob warned me well about making the right decisions, know when to turn around, and you're really programming that in. as part of my preparation to have that letter written was quite powerful, that if I was going through a dangerous part, if I was going through the Cumbo Icefall or something like that, that there was never going to be anything there that would allow me to linger on the thought of death, that, you know, I was really focused just on the task, because if my mind slipped onto the negatives, if that negative self-talk came in, I knew for me personally it was going to be really destructive. My self-confidence was going to dip fast. So if I got into a space where it was dangerous and where the thought of death might come in, by having, you know, nothing to worry about if I did die, and that everything was taken care of, that, you know, if I was going into that space now, I'm saying, God, do they know, and does my wife know I love her? Did I ever have I, when was the last time I told her, whatever it might be, that just by having it all dealt with, and that if I'm facing into dangerous part, there was no reason why it would fester or linger, or I'd have to spend time on it. So it was these real strange moments where you're preparing and writing these letters to kind of deal with that. Well, I think the place that worked, the part of my preparation that worked best for me was my psychological preparation. I work with a lady called Karen Weeks in Kinvara, and it was, yeah, it was the place that I performed, that I performed best. While physically I felt I was stronger than how I performed. I struggled on a lot of days earlier on, particularly, and I could have got really, really frustrated with that. Last year, 30% of people left base camp before the first weather window opened up. So, you know, some of it was because of sickness, but I'm sure a lot of it would have been because of, you know, psychologically they just weren't, you know, handling the fear or the blink contest with the mountain that Roger mentioned. So so psychologically I felt really well prepared, and, you know, that technique and a series of other, maybe my toolbox, I called it, a, you know, small sheet of paper, half an A4 that was laminated, that was in my backpack, and techniques that would help me get through, help me go to sleep, even help me just to remind myself of different techniques to help me sleep at night, or to deal with preparation for the following day, or if I was tired on the mountain, just different techniques I'd use to kind of, you know, re-energize myself mentally that would physically kind of help push me on, because it's very much a battle of the mind, probably more so than the body.
If everything else holds up, it comes down to the battle
of
the mind.
Yeah.
And there isn't, I mean, people might think that there's a lot of climbing when you're climbing Everest, but actually there's a lot of waiting around.
Absolutely,
and that's where the psychology can really get to you.
One team this year, their first, two people of a team, out of one team, the first trip through the icefall, which is really probably about day three or four after you arrive at base camp, the first trip through the icefall after they went about a third of the way through, and they came back to base camp and they helicoptered out of there. Just the experience of the ladders and the experience of what was going on around them was enough to kind of abandon ship. So,
yeah, and that's probably, to qualify those statements or my take on them would be, you know, the icefall in particular on the south side, it is a feature of the south side route, it is an objective danger, and it, which means things can go wrong without you putting a foot out of step. So in that point in time, you know, the people that turn around having gone through a portion of it might have decided that, look, they just don't like the feel of it. And equally, the letters, I was also, someone proposed to me that I write such letters as you did. I didn't do them. And, you know, who knows whether you should or shouldn't. But I'm sure your letters didn't act as a free pass to take whatever risks you see in front of you, you know, to maintain focus. You know, it was always supported by, you know, the team that was with you, that conscious decisions that were made about the mountain and the current circumstances you were facing. And quite often, you know, those letters can help as an extra little confidence booster once you've got all of the other, you know, levels of analysis complete for whatever might be ahead. I personally didn't write the letters because I felt that my confidence was fine in its own sense, but I truly wasn't going to take any risk that I felt would result in me not returning.
On our trip, we our mantra was Safety Science Summit. So the summit goal was the third thing. We had a very cohesive team, and we all had a very organized and quite disciplined approach to climbing. And even on the summit day, to take away the intellectual decision of how much oxygen you had, we radioed our values and readings to the guys at base camp, and they would work out our time and progress, and We had agreed that if they told us to turn around, we would turn around, okay. So that we didn't have to, we didn't even have to do any of the mental work of making a decision to turn around. That it was all going to be, we were going to outsource that to someone. Well, else.
Yeah. How do you deal? And I'm sure again you've prepared for this in advance, but walking past bodies of climbers as you're making your way to the summit, and not being able to do anything, it's like, especially as, I guess, that it may be different, but as a doctor, the feeling of helplessness, that there's nothing you can really do here.
Well, I mean, we were lucky enough that a few years before us, the all the bodies and rubbish and so on were cleared up from the mountain, so we didn't see any old dead bodies. There were four people who were killed on our side when we were there, and we got involved in some of the bringing down of their bodies, so we didn't leave them. We did get involved in a rescue. We had made a decision earlier on as doctors that morally we wouldn't walk past anyone, and we would put the full resource of our expedition behind a rescue. So when the weather window opened, and what I mean in a weather window is that the jet stream hits the top of Everest, so you get these 200 kilometre an hour winds for most of the year, and about 1 week in May and 1 week in October, the jet stream moves away and the wind speed drops to almost zero.
Okay.
So everyone gets in position ready for that day, and that's where you hear these stories about the bottlenecks and hundreds of people going, you know, on the same day. We strategically made a decision that we were going to hold back 3 days so that we would let the rush go, and then we would not be in a crowd of people. But because people knew there was a team of doctors high up on the mountain, people started just bringing sick people to us. And as I said, we'd made the decision that we were putting the full weight of our expedition behind rescues if needed. We got involved in one rescue of a girl called Usha Bisa, who was a Nepalese girl on a Nepalese expedition, and she'd been essentially left for dead at about the balcony, which is just 400 meters below the summit. And an American climber called Dave Hahn found her. She was cerebral edema, a small girl, maybe only 50 kilos. He dragged her down to our tents at Camp 4, and then for the rest of the evening and most of the next day, a team of about 32 people managed to carry her down to Camp 3, where we looked after her for a night. But to rescue one 50 kilo girl took about 30 people,
wow,
all working together. And you can just see how the difficulty of like an 80 kilo man who gets sick and can't walk. You as an individual, or even a pair, or even three people, are simply physically not going to be able to rescue that person. But as I said, we'd made the decision at an executive level early on in the expedition that we wouldn't walk past someone.
We've got to wrap up, unfortunately, but before we do, the obvious question, when you get to the top, when you get to the summit, the feeling that you'd imagined when you set that goal 10 years ago, John,
It was
worth it?
Certainly was. Yeah, I'd read a lot about Everest. I knew the moment could pass very easily, and you mightn't appreciate the moment. My body was feeling good on the summit night, which was great. And about an hour or two before I got to the summit on the final ridge, I started to visualize and appreciate that I was going to stand on top. And it was the first time, you know, since I set off on that journey 10 years before that I really said I'm going to stand on the top of Mount Everest, even though I was been on the mountain for 6 weeks at this stage. But it was the first time, and I suppose I kind of let the moment build up. And when I got to the top, yeah, there was, you know, a tearful kind of.
Long as you're there,
I spent about 25 minutes. 5 minutes really happy, really emotional. But for people at home and everyone that had helped me and all that, like, you really feel like it was for everybody as well. 5 minutes really emotional, really happy, and 20 minutes thinking about getting back down. I was only halfway there.
What about you, Rob?
I think it really, for me, settled in base camp. You know, I acknowledged the moment on the summit, took it in, absorbed the emotion, the feeling, but I locked it away pretty quick. And I said, you know, that's a little part of emotion that I want to reflect on in a few days when we get back down. You know, I'd had oxygen difficulties on the ascent, and I knew there was a long, dangerous descent ahead. So I had to maintain focus. Now, I'll admit, I spent a little bit longer than John ultimately on the summit. I make it sound like I spent 30 seconds there. I spent, time moves very fast, especially when you spent 2 months on a mountain. You don't see a few minutes go by. Mm. So, you know, I felt I'd spent 20 minutes up there, and when I looked at the time stamps of GPS and photographs, I could see that I spent 40 minutes.
Right.
But it flew by, and they made the long descent.
What about you, Roger?
Yeah, I was 25 minutes on the summit. I could tell by the timestamps on the camera, but there's this amazing moment where you can look north into almost the Gobi Desert in Tibet. You can turn your head and see the whole width of the Himalayan range, and you can see the green plains of India. And if you put your head in the middle, you can actually see the Gobi Desert, the whole Himalayas, and the plains of India in one view. And you really feel like you're on top of the world. I mean, it's incredible. You know, it's just amazing.
Has anything been ever able to match that moment?
Birth
of my children. Yeah. Of course.
Comes close.
It's been brilliant having you in. It's been fascinating stuff. Thanks a lot for joining us. And if anyone wants any advice or anything, any good websites they should check out?
Well, I think the Mountaineering Council of Ireland is a great place to start, you know, and it gives good resources for all around the country about getting into climbing.
I'm looking forward to 10 years' time. And someone says, I was listening to Off the Ball that Saturday afternoon, and that was the moment I knew I had to do it. Dr. Roger McMorrow, Rob Mortel, John Burke joining us in the studio. We'll take a quick break.
The Saturday Paddle on Off the Ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.